Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 209, Benedict Arnold and the Radicals. Now, we last left Philadelphia in episode 201, where I talked about Benedict Arnold taking command as military governor of the region and setting himself up in the Penn Mansion in downtown Philadelphia, recently vacated by British General William Howe. Arnold had shut down all exports and trade within Philadelphia in order to prevent property of the British Army from being removed or the property of local Tories that the revolutionary government might want to seize. Arnold profited from his position by making deals that allowed favored parties to purchase and sell goods that the government had locked down. This, of course, led local merchants to see the lockdown as a way for a few top military officials to profit at their expense. Much of the lockdowns was actually ordered by Congress and Washington to protect against the loss of British property that could be seized. However, Arnold allowed a Tory ship, the Charming Nancy, to leave port anyway, and it was discovered that he had received a financial interest in the ship. Locals saw the shutdown as a way for Arnold to shake down locals for a cut of the profits. If you wanted to move goods in Philadelphia, you had to pay to play. Shortly after Arnold had taken command of the city in the summer of 1778, two men met with him to form an agreement. They were James Meese, the clothier general of the Continental Army, and Meese's deputy, William West Jr. Both men had been Philadelphia merchants before the war. We don't know much about Meese's politics before the war. He seems to have been more focused on his business. In January 1776, Congress had tapped Meese to serve as a commissary for the Pennsylvania regiments that Congress was raising to send to Boston. Meese also served as a paymaster general for the army. In December of 1776, while Washington's nearly naked army was fleeing the British advance across New Jersey toward Philadelphia, Washington called on Congress to appoint a clothier general to centralize a concerted effort to get clothing for his soldiers. Washington appointed Meese, who served with the army as a civilian. Meese's efforts proved, let's say, less than effective. Over the following year, the army continued to suffer from unacceptable shortages of just about everything they needed. Meese seems to have done little to succeed in his role. Washington asked him to be present with the army, but Meese remained in Philadelphia, sending assistants to follow around the army. Congress had told Meese to appoint local purchasing agents in each state, but Meese does not appear to have done that either. It would probably be pretty easy to blame Meese or his assistants entirely for the complete failure to provide the soldiers with adequate clothing. Congress, however, refused to come up with adequate funds to buy the clothes. When an agent in Massachusetts purchased some materials at market prices, and taking into account that he had to buy it with depreciated continental dollars, Congress put a halt to his efforts because he was spending way too much money. Congress also would not provide funds for wagons to get the supplies from warehouses to the army. Whatever blame could be attributed to Congress, though, Meese's leadership was not impressing anyone, including Meese himself. In December of 1777, when Washington was at Valley Forge, Meese submitted his letter of resignation, citing poor health. He agreed to stay on until a replacement could be found. Neither Congress nor Washington found a replacement. More than 6 months later, as the army was leaving Valley Forge and the British were evacuating Philadelphia, Meese was still serving as clothier general. Washington had written to Congress calling for his replacement and noting that he was unfit for office. Congress formed a committee to investigate, but did not take any action. A frustrated Meese sent a copy of his original letter of resignation, arguing that he agreed he should no longer hold the office. Even so, Congress did not act to replace him. So, in the fall of 1778, with Arnold in command of Philadelphia, Meese still served as clothier general of the Continental Army. Part of Meese's job was to go through all the stores left in Philadelphia. If the goods were found to be the property of the British Army or of a Tory merchant, he had authority to seize those goods. If they were owned by a Patriot merchant, he had authority to take the goods and to compensate the merchant with continental dollars, which would be paid at the amounts valued by Congress. Merchants had no choice not to sell. They had to take what they were given, even if their goods could be worth many more times that amount on the private market. By all accounts, Meese did his job with regard to acquiring whatever goods might be of use to the army. But there were also a great deal of goods that were not of any particular use to the army. Meese and his assistant formed a partnership with Arnold. The three men agreed to purchase these goods not needed by the army at cost, then turn around and sell them on the private market for a huge profit, which the three men would divide among themselves. Meese and his assistant would do all the work of strong-arming merchants into selling their goods at below market cost. Arnold would keep the shops closed and continue the ban on any exports from the city in order to give his partnership a monopoly on all sales. To the modern ear, all of this sounds rather shady, and to many people at the time, it sounded pretty shady as well. But all of this was being done under the authority of the Continental Congress, and there were no specific laws barring the practices being employed. Arnold had seen more senior generals, particularly Philip Schuyler, mix military assets with private business in order to make a profit. To Arnold, this just seemed like his turn at the trough. He could finally receive his financial reward for all the sacrifice and suffering that he had made in the early years of the war. Of course, to the merchants of Philadelphia who were being exploited, this just looked like corruption and abuse of power. Local officials began to complain loudly. Arnold, as the man in charge, became the target of their wrath. Arnold, however, did not seem to pay much attention to the criticism. He viewed the complaints as the buzzing of insects, annoying but to be ignored. In addition to his profiteering, Arnold rather quickly took other actions which incurred the wrath of the local patriots. One was his ostentatious display of wealth. The military governor began riding around town in a fancy coach with livery servants and furnishing his residence in the Penn Mansion with some of the finest furniture and decor that could be found, much of which was acquired through his partnership with Meese. Arnold's other offensive behavior involved his close association with local Philadelphia loyalists. Many of the wealthiest people in town who remained in Philadelphia during the British occupation had worked with the British in order to maintain their property and keep their businesses going. As I mentioned in an earlier episode, many patriots wanted them to pay for their collaboration. In the fall of 1778, local courts had convicted and hanged several collaborators. Others wanted these wealthy families who collaborated with the enemy at least to lose their property and possibly be expelled from the state. Arnold, instead, seemed to spend most of his time socializing with these very same people. After all, they were the upper class of the town. With his newfound wealth, powerful position, and prestigious title, Arnold had entree into the top of Philadelphia society. He wanted to take full advantage of that. Arnold made clear his position as a moderate early in his administration. Joseph Galloway had been a civilian leader under British-occupied Philadelphia and was probably considered the top collaborator who had not been arrested prior to the British occupation. The only reason he hadn't been arrested was because he had fled to British-occupied New York, where he assisted General Howe in planning the Philadelphia campaign. Galloway had wisely fled Philadelphia with the British Army and returned to New York. There, Galloway and his daughter Betsy would take a ship to London, never to return to their home in America. His wife, however, Grace Galloway, remained in her family mansion just north of town. Pennsylvania's Supreme Executive Council seized her home as the property of a loyalist. Mrs. Galloway refused to leave and locked herself in the mansion. The Supreme Executive Council ordered Arnold to remove her from the property and throw her into the street. Arnold had sent guards to protect Mrs. Galloway from violence, but had to comply with civilian orders. But he sent an officer to convince Galloway to leave voluntarily and gave her access to a coach to take her to her relatives. This relatively kind eviction upset the radicals. After Galloway's eviction, Joseph Reed moved into the mansion for use as his personal residence. As much as the radicals despised Arnold's behavior, much of Arnold's behavior was in line with what he thought Congress and Washington wanted him to do. Arnold had received orders to heal the city and to encourage the locals who had worked under British rule to get back to work and start being productive in a way that would help the American cause. Congress wanted a productive city that would show a return to normal, and which would provide more goods and services to benefit the war effort. Engaging in acts of petty revenge would not serve that end. Arnold's display of wealth was not necessarily out of line either. The people of his generation had not fully adopted the egalitarian values that later generations would display to the public. Flashy exhibitions of wealth were expected from leaders. Washington did much the same thing. Arnold's attempts to live extravagantly was expected by someone in his position. Even so, Arnold's high living only highlighted the fact that he was raking in tens of thousands of pounds from his private commercial dealings. Those were only possible because of his position as military governor, and which were directly contributing to the suffering of many locals. His socializing with loyalist families only increased local anger, as his actions seemed to benefit rich loyalists at the expense of hard-working patriots. Rather than focusing on the optics of what he was doing, Arnold's attention focused on love. As I mentioned already, he began dating Peggy Shippen, the teenage daughter of a wealthy Philadelphia merchant who many suspected of loyalist tendencies. Arnold's first wife had died in 1775. For a time, Arnold focused on the war, leaving his sister to raise his children. Over a year later, Arnold fell in love with a 15-year-old Boston girl, the daughter of a loyalist named Betsy Dubois. He wooed her for about 2 years, but the parents would not allow the relationship. In Philadelphia, Arnold moved to an older woman, the then 17-year-old Peggy Shippen. Again, the loyalist father, Edward Shippen, was reluctant about the relationship, but ended up allowing it to continue. Arnold and Peggy were seen riding around town in his carriage and walking together at Bartram's Gardens. Within a few months, and after Peggy's 18th birthday, Arnold proposed marriage. Her father reluctantly agreed, but asked the couple to wait until the following spring. So much of Arnold's attention was focused on his upcoming wedding and how to support his new wife in style. Meanwhile, the radicals focused on Arnold's activities and made him a target. Joseph Reed was elected president of Pennsylvania in December 1778 and made ending Arnold's military rule one of his top priorities. One of the first changes that Reed and the Executive Council made was to get the Continental Congress to take away Arnold's power to issue passes to civilians. This was in response to passes that Arnold had issued to move some of his personal property through the city at a time when no one else could do so. Of course, an issue arose where a woman named Hannah Levy was trying to get a pass to get out of town. Levy was a relative of Major David Franks, who was Arnold's top military aide. Major Franks' uncle was a wealthy Philadelphia merchant who had thrown parties for General Howe and other top officers during the occupation and was considered a collaborator. Arnold requested a pass for Miss Levy, but the council denied it. She was related to a suspected loyalist, and the council was in no mood to do any favors for General Arnold. Instead, Arnold gave Levy a personal note instructing soldiers to allow her to pass. When Reed found out and confronted Arnold about this effort to ignore the council's rules, Arnold told Reed that Levy was on a military mission for him, that the matter was secret, and he would not disclose the purpose to Reed or the council. On another occasion, Major Franks ordered the sentry at his home to go fetch a barber. The sentry, Pennsylvania Militia Sergeant William Matlock, was not happy about leaving his post to go run personal errands for the officer and asked if this was the way soldiers were treated. He told Franks that he would go if directly ordered to do so by the officer, but would also lodge a complaint. Franks cursed out the soldier and slammed the door in his face. The sergeant did go to Arnold with the complaint. Arnold said he would look into it, but did nothing. Sergeant Matlock, the man who made the complaint, also happened to be the son of Timothy Matlock, who served on the Supreme Executive Council and was friends with Joseph Reed. Soon, newspaper editorials were complaining about the use of soldiers as servants. This also played into attitudes that Arnold and his fellow officers were acting more like loyalists and refusing to respect the rights of patriotic Americans. Another issue that caused Arnold and Reed to butt heads was the case of the Active, a British sloop. In the summer of 1778, the ship had captured several Connecticut fishermen, including a man named Gideon Olmsted, who were out at sea at the time. The Navy impressed them into service. The ship then sailed to Jamaica and then was headed back to New York. While still at sea, Olmsted and his fellow captives managed to lock the crew below decks and take control of the ship. After considerable struggle, they managed to bring the ship into Egg Harbor, New Jersey. As they approached the harbor, another ship, the Convention, which was owned by the state of Pennsylvania, boarded the ship and claimed it as a prize. Olmsted and his men said they were already in control of the ship and that the prize was theirs. The case went to the Supreme Executive Council, which ruled in favor of itself and kept the money. Olmsted then turned to Arnold for justice. Arnold agreed to front some of the money to Olmsted and his shipmates, and also provided some legal assistance in exchange for a share of the winnings. Reed was outraged that the military governor was involving himself in this state matter involving property rights. The Continental Congress set up an investigative committee and ruled in favor of Olmsted. Despite the ruling, Reed and the Pennsylvania courts refused to turn over the proceeds from the sale of the ship. The two sides would continue the legal battle for decades, long after Arnold had died. The U.S. Supreme Court finally resolved the matter in Olmsted's favor more than 30 years later in 1809. In February of 1779, all of the fighting between Arnold and his officers with Reed and the local politicians went to the next level. Arnold made plans in January to go visit General Philip Schuyler in New York. Schuyler was working on a land scheme to take possession of thousands of acres of land confiscated from Loyalists in upstate New York. Arnold was to get a chance to buy in and become a partial owner of land that would certainly be sold at a huge profit. Arnold left Philadelphia in early February, headed for New York. Along the way, he stopped in Middlebrook, New Jersey, to spend a few days with General Washington, bringing him up to date on events in Philadelphia and discussing future plans. Washington welcomed his old friend and invited Arnold to stay with him. The two generals spent several days catching up. While with Washington, a courier came looking for Arnold to inform him that the Supreme Executive Council had brought 8 criminal charges against Arnold. The charges were: 1. Granting an unauthorized pass to a Tory ship leaving port, closing down all shops while making purchases for his personal benefit, imposing menial services on militia, i.e. the Matlack incident, taking a financial interest in the legal dispute over the ship Active, using state wagons to transport Tory property for private gain, granting passes to civilians after Congress assigned that power to the state, treating the council with disrespect after it inquired about the use of the wagons, and finally a more general charge of, quote, cold and neglectful treatment of patriot authorities, both civil and military, with an entirely different line of conduct toward adherents of the king, by which they meant local Tories. Not only had Reed and the council brought these charges against Arnold while he was away from the city, they also published them in the local newspapers. Arnold discussed the matter with Washington, who seemed to support Arnold in this matter. At least that is what Arnold wrote in a letter to Peggy Shippen at the time. Washington suggested that Arnold seek a military court-martial to clear his name. Arnold canceled his travel plans and returned to Philadelphia, demanding an immediate hearing on the charges. The council refused to hold a hearing right away, while Reed was seeking to have the Continental Congress suspend Arnold from his command until the matter was resolved. Congress formed a committee to look into the matter. Arnold defended himself on the charges at a hearing in March. After the hearing, Congress threw out 6 of the 8 charges, allowing only 2 to proceed. Granting an unauthorized pass for a Tory ship, the Charming Nancy, to leave port, and for closing the shops while benefiting from personal purchases of goods. Arnold seemed happy with the outcome and was confident that the remaining charges would also be dismissed after the hearing. On March 19th, he resigned his position as military governor of Philadelphia. He was still a major general, but did not have any command. He and Peggy continued their plans for a wedding in April. As a wedding present, Arnold purchased a large estate known as Mount Pleasant. This, of course, only outraged Reed and the radicals even further. They questioned how Arnold could afford such a purchase other than through his corruption. Of course, Arnold had heavily mortgaged his purchase based on the expectation that Congress was going to repay his debts that they still owed him for his personal outlays while in the field. We're going to have to pick up that story in a future episode, but we will end on the happy note that Arnold and Peggy were married on April 6, 1779, and looked forward to a lifetime of happiness together. Next week, we're going to head out west as the Americans attack the British at Fort Vincennes in what is today Indiana. Hi, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, Trey Nance, George Davis, Lewis White, and George Hunter. Thanks also to Robert Morris Circle supporter Mike Hager. I also want to welcome Matthew Saxton and Cole Epperson, who joined on Patreon at the Standard Bearer level in June. You guys will be getting your first monthly flag magnet this month. I really rely on Patreon donations to help keep this podcast going. I hope that anyone out there who can consider offering some support for as little as $2 a month would go over to patreon.com, look up American Revolution Podcast, and make a monthly pledge. It really helps me to keep the podcast free for everyone who can't afford to make such a contribution. One quick correction from last week. I referenced a British officer who led the attack on Fort Morris before the fort finally fell as Colonel Lewis. In fact, the officer's name was Lieutenant Colonel Lewis Valentine Fuser. For some reason, I just started calling him by his first name, Colonel Lewis, through the episode. In fact, it was Colonel Fuser. Thanks to Dan Elliott for pointing out that mistake. In this week's episode, we started to take a look at the beginning of Benedict Arnold's fall. He resigns as military governor while charges are against him and awaits his court-martial. Arnold does not seem terribly concerned at this point. He sees the sniping by politicians in Pennsylvania as a nuisance, and he seems to think that his military service will protect him from any convictions by his fellow officers. Instead, he seems focused on his new life with his young wife, Peggy. Some people who look at Arnold's later treason really want to lay the blame completely on Peggy, his new wife, for the decision to betray his country. Peggy probably did assist with the first contact between Arnold and Major André, which took place about the time that they were married, and she almost certainly encouraged her new husband by telling him that he was such a great officer, he could do well in either army, and that the Americans just didn't appreciate his greatness. But in the end, Arnold's treason seems to be based more on his disaffection with the American cause and the way he was being treated. The British monarchy had always rewarded great military leaders. The Americans seemed not only not interested in providing rewards, but seemed to be going after him for what he saw as BS ethics charges. This probably convinced Arnold that, along with all the problems of inflation and the inability to supply the army, that the Patriot cause was doomed, and that taking the offer to switch sides at this time would be the best thing he could do for himself and his family. The fact is, as I said, Arnold had, even before his court-martial, opened up secret correspondence with the British, so at this point he was really already seriously considering treason. The politics at this time in Philadelphia seemed to be taking a dangerous turn. We see this in a great many revolutions. The idealistic leaders want to cleanse their new society of all those who are not completely committed to the cause. In many revolutions, this ends up leading to mass murder or reign of terror. That never happened in America. However, the Pennsylvania government was showing tendencies in that direction. And you can probably understand why that's a tempting way to think. If you and your fellow patriots are suffering, some even dying for the cause, and you have all these other folks who are just willing to back the other side as long as they can keep their vast wealth and property, there's bound to be some resentment, and a feeling that the revolution cannot progress until you get rid of those people. It's a tempting but dangerous line of thought. I have recommended several Arnold biographies in the past. This week's recommendation really focuses on this particular period of his life. It's called Benedict Arnold in Philadelphia by Ray Thompson. Now, the book was written in 1975 amidst a string of books pushed out just ahead of the bicentennial. It's a fairly short one at under 200 pages, but as I said, it focuses on Arnold's time in Philadelphia after the British occupation, and I think paints a pretty good picture of what was happening there at the time. The book is out of print and may be hard to find. I was lucky that my library had a copy, but I think it is an interesting account of the pivotal period in Arnold's life that is not emphasized by many of the other Arnold biographies. So, if you can find Benedict Arnold in Philadelphia, I think it's worth reading. My online recommendation this week looks at another interesting side note to Arnold's life. It is an online article called Betsy Dubloy, The Girl Who Got Away from Benedict Arnold. As I mentioned in the main episode, Arnold had been pursuing another teenage daughter of a loyalist, this one in Boston, before he met Peggy. It seems to show that Arnold was eager to start a new life by acquiring a trophy wife and living as an upper-class gentleman. The article is on the New England Historical Society website, and I think is an interesting read. As always, I've included a direct link on my website at www.amrevpodcast.com. My listener question this week comes from Andrew Ray, asking why soldiers of this era did not wear helmets or other protective headgear. And it's an interesting question because we see soldiers of earlier eras wearing helmets. For example, the conquistadors all have those famous helmets. But by the 18th century, everyone seems to be wearing hats, and then of course by the early 20th century, we're all back to helmets again. The reason is that earlier helmets were good at stopping a sword or an arrow, but when the age of muskets came about, the iron helmets that soldiers would have had to wear would have had to have been too big and too heavy to have been of much utility. Metal helmets were also expensive, and if they didn't do much to provide real protection, then they were not worth the cost. Now, some soldiers during this era did wear helmets. The Hessians, for example, wore bronze helmets during the war, but these were more expensive decorative adornments than anything that was supposed to provide any real protection. It wouldn't be until the mass production of steel came about in the late 19th century that we see a return to protective helmets. And that really begins in World War I. Of course, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered on this podcast, please email me at mtroy.history@gmail.com. Well, that's all for this week. Please join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.